COVID-19 is in Puerto Rico. The island's government is taking drastic steps to slow its spread.
Just the other day, someone tried to sit down in an empty plaza to have their breakfast, and private guards threw them away. Police have gone into the beaches and have cleared tourists and residents from the beaches.
I'm Duarte Geraldino, and today on The Takeaway, we look at how economic crises and natural disasters in Puerto Rico are affecting the island's response. Plus, in D.C., Congress is working on how to get some cash flowing to you.
They are talking now about a bigger, broader stimulus package where they would be sending checks to individuals.
And then we get some other news. Yes, there is other news out there. We're talking women's soccer and the equal pay lawsuit filed by the U.S. national soccer team.
U.S. soccer essentially said that things that women are born with are inherently inferior to men.
All right, busy show. Let's get going. We start with COVID-19 and the domino effect it's having in the U.S. and around the globe. It's a surreal scene around the world. Restaurants, stores, and borders are being shuttered. The European Union is restricting non-essential travel for a month. And while you are likely starting to get used to self-isolation, people in three states were standing in long lines, sometimes for hours at a time, very close to each other, waiting to vote. This despite the Trump administration's warnings that gatherings of 10 or more people are dangerous and should be avoided. Florida, Illinois, and Arizona primary voters gave a big win to Joe Biden. Now, there are thousands of confirmed coronavirus cases in the U.S. right now, and those are just the ones we know about. And yet, Puerto Rico is recording only a small number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 so far, and no deaths? This is despite hundreds of calls to medical centers. Obviously, those numbers will grow. Now, the island's governor, Wanda Vasquez, issued guidelines that are more strict than anywhere on the U.S. mainland, a 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew. Most businesses are closed for the next 2 weeks, and if you are on the island, you can only leave your house for food, medicine, or to go to the bank. If you break those rules on the island, you could get a hefty fine or even be arrested. Now, we've covered Puerto Rico's financial and political turmoil very carefully over the last couple of years, including the aftermath of devastating natural disasters there. These are all now factors in the Puerto Rican response to COVID-19. Danica Cotto is with us now. She's a correspondent for the Associated Press who covers the Caribbean. She's been in Puerto Rico covering the coronavirus response there. Danica, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Also with us is Arelis Hernandez, who is a correspondent for the Washington Post. She has also extensively reported on Puerto Rico. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, Danica, what does it look like in Puerto Rico in the age of this virus?
Well, the streets are pretty bare. It's a bit eerie. You don't really see that much traffic, especially at night. And most people are heeding the warnings and following the executive order. Just the other day, someone tried to sit down in an empty plaza to have their breakfast, and private guards threw them away. Police have gone into the beaches and have cleared tourists and residents from the beaches. So everyone's pretty much staying at home and biding their time for at least 2 weeks until, you know, any new orders might be given.
Arelis, why is it important for Puerto Rico in particular to have such a drastic response?
Well, I think the governor has received some criticism about how quickly they've responded to the situation, first of all. And secondly, Puerto Rico has a really high percentage of the population that's elderly and have pre-existing conditions and chronic diseases. Added that to the fact that the healthcare system has been near collapse for some time, Puerto Rico is in a particularly precarious position.
I understand. I've heard some stats about 1 in 5 Puerto Ricans on the island is over 65 years old. Is that 20%? Is that correct?
As far as I know, that I think it might be even a little bit higher than that. But, you know, you add on to that the number of people who are, you know, disabled or who depend on things like dialysis. I think the rate of the pervasiveness of diabetes on the island is like 50% higher, I think, in Puerto Rico than in the mainland. So, yes, there's a, you know, substantial elderly population, but there's also a bunch of sick people in Puerto Rico.
Danica, how are these measures, like the curfew in particular, being enforced on the ground?
Well, these officers are working 12-hour shifts right now. So they're patrolling the streets, especially from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. They recently announced that they would no longer be warning people and businesses who are found outside during those hours. So previously, they cited more than 170 people and businesses said, you know, you're not supposed to be open, you're not supposed to be outside. And now they will only receive a citation to appear in court. And they could also receive fines up to $5,000. The governor has warned that if people keep disrespecting the executive order, that she will implement harsher measures, including pulling liquor licenses and other permits.
$5,000 is a lot of money for everybody, but on the island, given the fact that earnings are so low, that's a particularly heavy burden, no?
It is a very steep fine. Puerto Rico's reaching almost a 14-year recession. It's still trying to juggle its $70 billion public debt load, which part of it has been restructured. But this is definitely a heavy, heavy blow for people who have not been able to work, spending 2 weeks inside at home. Some people have been worried about an increase in their power and their water bills as a result of this curfew as well.
Adelise, what about testing? It's been an issue for many places around the world. What's the situation in Puerto Rico?
Puerto Rico, I believe this week, says that they have some ability to test locally through their, I think, biohazards team. But I believe that's limited in the way that it's limited in other communities across the country. And early on, again, with the criticism that's been levying against the governor and responding to this, they did not have any local capacity to test and to see, you know, whether they have to send that out. You know, they'll take specimens with some of the first cases with that Italian tourist who came off the passenger cruise ship. You know, they have to send those out to Atlanta and CDC. And, you know, that takes a while in the U.S. mainland. Imagine how much longer it takes for Puerto Rico being in an island several thousand miles away.
So every test that needs to be done has to be the samples collected on the island, then it's flown back to the mainland. During that time, that person could infect other people. Is that the risk?
Yes, absolutely the risk. And an acute risk in Puerto Rico is that you have a lot of the folks who are working, healthcare workers, nurses, things like that, that work in the hospitals that are dealing with some of these cases, also happen to work part-time jobs in nursing homes across the island. It's, you know, a practice that's existed for a really long time. And so you have these folks who are, you know, doing their shifts in the hospitals, you might be working overtime, being exposed to some of these patients, and then going into senior homes where, you know, they could be further exposing and spreading this. I don't know what measures the government so far has taken, maybe Danica, in terms of sort of stemming that.
Puerto Rico's government did get permission this week to start testing people. So thankfully, they no longer have to send the test over to the U.S. mainland, which does cut down on that time. However, yesterday, the government was severely criticized following a press conference in which officials said that very strict criteria would apply to determine whether someone would get tested. And one of those criteria would be whether the person has traveled. So, of course, many people said, well, what about, you know, local transmission? What about people who are not showing symptoms? And so early this morning, the government announced to the tears of many people that doctors are now allowed to independently test people for COVID-19. They no longer need to go to the health department to request permission. And part of the problem was that the health department was denying these requests if someone had specifically not traveled outside of Puerto Rico. In addition, the governor announced today that it already asked the FAA to shut down the main international airport and other airports across the island. So basically, she wants a permanent, temporary stop to all domestic and international flights to and from Puerto Rico for 2 weeks. If that is not granted, she has also asked that flights be limited to the airports where screenings are being held. And at this point, the only airport doing that is the main international airport in San Juan, where about 280 National Guard members are screening all passengers coming from anywhere, the U.S. mainland and other countries. And they hope to start that at four other airports by the end of the week, including another international airport in the town of Aguadilla.
Puerto Rico faced severe earthquakes just a few short months ago. How will that impact the spread of the coronavirus?
I think intensely, right? I haven't checked the latest number, but I think there are still hundreds of people that are living in sort of itinerant conditions and camps, either, you know, just outside their homes or in sort of these government set up camps in which they're eking out a living through that. And the hygiene conditions in those places, though it's gotten better since the early days of the earthquakes, is still a problem for a lot of folks. Again, you know, staying clean while you're living outdoors or you're trying to keep germs at bay or something as deadly as this virus is going to be a challenge for those folks.
We know that Puerto Rico has had a lot of political and financial turmoil in just its recent history. What about funding for disaster recovery? Is that going to be a problem?
I think with the, I don't remember exactly the number, but they've already dipped into their emergency funding this year, if that's right, Danica. And so they've asked for more money for this particular emergency. Keep in mind that Puerto Rico is finances. Their entire budget is overseen by an oversight board that came through PROMESA legislation back in 15 or 16. And so Puerto Rico doesn't independently or isn't supposed to independently make decisions about their finances without the approval of this unelected board. They've dipped into this fund, this emergency fund that was set aside budget-wise already with the earthquakes and other things that have happened. This is just going to place an additional burden on, you know, that particular fund. And it'd be interesting to see what kind of flexibility the oversight board gives to the government of Puerto Rico to be able to respond to this. But, you know, the economic ramifications of, you know, shutting down Puerto Rico, an island that largely or a huge part of the economy depends on tourism, is going to be insignificant. I don't think we even know the ways that, you know, this could hurt Puerto Rico's economy in the future.
Donica, did you want to add?
Sure. Actually, the board which oversees the island's finances, so basically that means that Puerto Rico needs to get permission from the board to use any money for certain purposes, including, you know, this type of situation. So the board agreed a couple of days ago to free up $160 million to address the situation. However, the government does say it needs more. And in addition, it's requested if it could delay the revision of a fiscal plan, which implements, you know, several austerity measures.
So, you know, one of the things that a lot of people are wondering right now is that Puerto Rico has often been criticized for not acting quickly enough in the past in response to disasters like this. At least, is this time different? Are they facing as much criticism?
So I've been talking to some folks who work in emergency response and in the health, you know, health field. And I think there's still significant amount of criticism that she should have shut down the island to cruise ship passengers a little earlier. And that they waited too long for their first case to begin to take preventative measures on the island, considering how vulnerable its population is to something like this, an epidemic like this. You know, when that Italian, when sort of news of that first case of that Italian tourist coming, you know, onto the island, there was a bit of criticism that I heard here, and I'm based in Texas, from folks who are wondering, you know, what kind of measures did the government take to secure that ambulance, to make sure that this person was placed in isolation, and criticism specifically of the Secretary of Health, who had since resigned, and sort of downplaying and it's, you know, it seemed as though dismissive of the fact that this was something that could spread within the community. And that's where the criticism has come. However, I think some of that has been tempered by the correction that's been made and this sort of decisive action that the governor has taken now. That being said, you know, if you're a business owner and you're having to shut down your bar for 2 weeks or not able to sort of make the money that you typically expect within that time frame, you probably have a gripe as well.
Danica Goto is a correspondent for the AP covering the Caribbean, and Arelis Hernandez is a correspondent for the Washington Post. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And remember, all of our coverage on Puerto Rico is at thetakeaway.org/Puerto Rico. On Tuesday, the Trump administration announced a proposal for an $850 billion stimulus package, which still needs congressional approval. All of that money would be earmarked for the hotel industry, the airline industry, and you.
We're looking at sending checks to Americans immediately. And what we've heard from hardworking Americans, many companies have now shut down, whether it's bars or restaurants. Americans need cash now, and the president wants to get cash now. And I mean now, in the next 2 weeks.
That's Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. This week, he said President Trump directed him to carry out this measure. Earlier this week, the House passed another bill which includes provisions for paid sick leave, unemployment insurance, money for nutrition services, and other benefits to workers. The House bill deals with far less money, only about $100 billion. Kate Davison is an economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She's here to help us understand what these packages could actually mean for you if they pass. Hey, Kate.
Hi.
So there are some changes being made to the House package on paid sick leave that were made earlier this week. When it comes to paid sick leave, how does this latest version differ from the initial bill?
Well, they took some steps on Monday to scale some of the provisions back from the initial bill. So the bill would provide 2 weeks of paid sick leave. And the way that's set up is employers would get a tax credit when they file their taxes. So essentially, it would require businesses to just keep paying workers. What they scaled back, though, was the extended leave. It would provide an additional 10 weeks of paid leave at two-thirds of your pay under the Family and Medical Leave Act. And that was originally for anyone who was homesick or home caring for an ill family member, and also for people who had to be home because their kids' daycare or school was closed. They scaled that back, so now it only applies, those extra 10 weeks is only for people who are home with kids whose daycares or schools have closed. So the initial version would have represented a big sort of expansion of FMLA, but there was a lot of pushback from businesses. And so I think in order to move this bill through the Republican-controlled Senate, that was a compromise that was made at some point over the weekend, and the House voted on it Monday night.
Considering how vulnerable healthcare workers are to infection, why are they going to be excluded from those provisions?
Right. I mean, that's a good point. The healthcare workers, too, that was another another change that I didn't mention. They now, there's going to be a rule. The labor secretary has discretion to implement this rule that they also could be considered excluded. And part of that was businesses were worried, businesses that run, you know, assisted living facilities and nursing homes, places where there are seniors who are more vulnerable. There was this concern that if everyone took these paid leave provisions and stayed home with their kids, there wouldn't be enough workers to support those businesses. And so they included those exemptions. And on the one hand, you can, I guess, kind of understand that argument that you don't want to be without those workers. On the other hand, the point of these provisions are to make sure that people, if they are feeling sick, have that time, you know, that they're able to stay home and not spread the infection. So Speaker Nancy Pelosi came out with a statement yesterday saying that she wanted to try to restore some of those provisions in subsequent packages. So we might see that they try to make that, you know, bring that provision back in a future bill.
Earlier you mentioned that if someone gets this paid sick leave, they would get two-thirds of their pay. Is that money then taxed, or is that tax-free?
My understanding is that you know, that's still income that will be taxed normally. Separately, though, they are talking now about a bigger, broader stimulus package where they would be sending checks to individuals. And I'm not 100% sure of the tax implications of that, but it would definitely provide, I think people see that as perhaps more effective than something like a payroll tax cut that would be spread out over your paychecks. Sending a direct check for, say, $1,000 or perhaps even more than that per person is designed to really be more of a buffer against, you know, potential shocks. If you're not able to work, say if you're a contract worker where you're not getting this paid sick leave, it would help people like that.
Would these be one-time checks or would these be monthly checks?
This would be a one-time payment, and officials are still sort of working out the details. The White House just yesterday announced that this is something that they're looking at, which is quite a turnaround from a week or 2 weeks ago where, you know, I was talking to people in the administration who said, no, we're really not at that point. We really don't think that that's necessary. It's better to target the aid at people who really need it, like people who are sick and are missing work. And now they're looking at something much more, much more comprehensive. And it's possible they could do it in waves. So they've said that they might do an initial $250 billion of checks, and that there might be some means testing to that. So it might not go to everyone. You know, they wouldn't send them to millionaires and billionaires, obviously. But I think that the goal is to send them as widely as possible.
Any sense of how it might impact lower income Americans?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is another reason why is that these checks are designed to be more beneficial for lower income Americans. So if they did a payroll tax, for example, and that tax, which is 12.4%, went to zero, a person who makes $100,000 is going to benefit a lot more than that. You know, that's a larger that share of their income is a bigger dollar figure than someone who makes, you know, $25,000 or $30,000. Whereas if everyone gets a check for $1,000, it's the same amount for everyone. That's going to have a bigger benefit on lower income individuals. So that's another part of the reason there is it could be potentially helpful for people who are more vulnerable.
Kate, are any industries in particular being prioritized in the Trump administration's $850 billion package?
Yes, it seems so far the airlines are definitely an industry that the president, his Treasury Secretary, and others have singled out because obviously a lot of people are not flying right now. Their business has really dropped off, and they've expressed concern that they could be insolvent in several months if they don't get help from the government. And officials have said, we want to make sure that people are still able to travel domestically. That's why this is a priority. And so their argument is, these aren't bailouts. Airlines also employ a lot of workers. And so we want to extend help to them. So right now, there's about $50 billion that they're targeting. None of this is set in stone yet, but this is their proposal. But they have also said that they intend to try to target some aid for other businesses in that, like hospitality industry, hotels, cruise lines. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a big push by restaurants as well. I mean, obviously, a lot of businesses in the economy, almost every business is affected by this. So for right now, definitely a push for airlines, but I think that we'll see more to come.
Kate Davidson is an economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Kate, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
With the worldwide focus on coronavirus, you might have missed what the Department of Justice did this week. The DOJ dropped charges against two Russian firms accused of funding efforts to interfere in the 2016 election. The charges against Concord Management and Concord Consulting go back 2 years. They came out of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. Now, a trial was set to begin in just a couple of weeks, though it's likely the coronavirus pandemic would have delayed it. But now, prosecutors have dropped their plans for the trial entirely. They're citing several very interesting reasons for this apparently abrupt decision. Max Kuttner is a frequent guest on The Takeaway. He follows all things DOJ in Russia and beyond. Max, so great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Max, what are these companies and what are they actually accused of doing?
So Concord Management and Consulting and Concord Catering, these are companies that are run by a person known as Putin's chef. This is a Russian oligarch. And these companies are accused of funding the Russian interference operation that we've been hearing so much about for the past couple of years. This was allegedly run by what was called the Internet Research Agency. And this was hundreds of employees allegedly posing as Americans, creating social media accounts, creating ads, all to sow discord in the 2016 election. These Concord companies are the ones that were funding this effort, allegedly.
So they were footing the bill for all of this. Now, how had the case been shaping up to this point, and how did it differ from cases that resulted from Mueller's investigation?
So the main difference, Duarte, is that most of the Russians that were indicted in this case did not appear. They didn't have representation. They stayed out of it. So these charges come from February 2018. Mueller announced the indictment against 13 Russian individuals and three Russian companies. It was these Concord companies that participated in the process. The rest of the Russians did not. And because they participated and there was some back and forth, there was this opportunity for the charges now to be dismissed and for this issue to arise to begin with.
So it seems like a valid case, and yet the DOJ is dropping everything. What specifically did they say and cite for this apparently abrupt decision?
The reason they gave was that the national security concerns outweighed the potential for moving forward, the potential benefit for moving forward, especially since little can be done in the U.S. to really punish the Russians adequately.
National security? Why? Make that link for me. How is national security at play here?
So according to these prosecutors, documents that they had turned over as part of the case, as part of discovery, were then being used by the Russians in disinformation efforts. So The Russians were actually seeking material through the legitimate court system, the U.S. court system, and then using it against the Americans. And it was to such an extent that the Americans basically said, it's not worth it anymore. Now, given the atmosphere we're in right now with the Justice Department, some people are skeptical about this reason.
So what types of information are we talking about that prosecutors were worried about Concord getting its hands on?
They're talking about government procedures, government tools, and what's known in the national security world as sources and methods. So they were really trying to figure out, they wanted to get as much information about the U.S. process and the U.S. national security process as they could and use it in their own disinformation campaigns. And so the prosecutors believed this risk of exposure, which might have even, had it continued, might have even involved previously classified information, they decided that risk of exposure was just too high and was not worth continuing this prosecution. That's according to the DOJ.
So even if the DOJ had won the case, the country would have lost because this information would have been continued to be used against the U.S.
That's what the prosecutors believe, and there probably would not have been very much punishment available. It wasn't. It wouldn't be like we've seen in the other Mueller cases, where because they were in almost all cases American citizens, they were then able to either sentence them to prison or come up with other agreements with them.
So what's happening in Washington? What are lawmakers in the White House saying about this?
So it's really interesting seeing how the anti-Trump crowd and the anti-Mueller crowd are shaping the same narrative that happened. So obviously this comes as there has been what some believe is a dismantling of Mueller's work at the Justice Department. So Attorney General Bill Barr has launched probes into the origins of the Russia investigation. President Trump just a few days ago said he was considering a pardon for Michael Flynn. The senior leadership at the Justice Department recommended a softer sentencing recommendation for Roger Stone to the point where the prosecutors in that case actually withdrew. So there have been a number of these things. And so the anti-Trump crowd, as I've seen on Twitter, both in Congress and among the general public, when they see that the Justice Department is dropping these Russian charges, they see this as part of that effort to dismantle the work of Robert Mueller. And Representative Adam Schiff is one of those people. He said in a statement that this raises the question of, quote, what is really motivating this change of course. On the other hand, Duarte, the anti-Mueller crowd has seen this as a victory against what they believe is the deep state and what they believe is charges that never should have happened to begin with. So Victoria Tensing, she's a lawyer who at one point was going to join Trump's legal team. She said that she tweeted, corrupt special counsel Mueller lawyers had to dismiss bogus case against Concord. Reason for dismissal, not enough sufficient evidence, which doesn't even really seem accurate to me. And then Michael Flynn's lawyer tweeted something also. She actually tweeted, congratulations to Concord lawyers who knew how to defend. So really interesting to see how both sides are taking the same narrative of what happened.
So how could this affect efforts to protect the 2020 election?
This is going to come up again and again. This is only, in my opinion, going to help President Trump. He already has this narrative of, you know, the Democrats came at me with these Russia investigations. Mueller came at me with this Russia investigation to relitigate 2016, and I was exonerated. And this is yet another example of how the charges were bogus. So Trump, I believe, on the campaign trail is going to echo what we heard from those two lawyers who I just mentioned.
Max Kuttner is a journalist who covers the Justice Department and much more. Max, always good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I got an update for you on a story we've been following, the fight for equal pay in women's soccer. Carlos Cordero resigned this week. He's the president of the U.S. Soccer Federation. Now, he quit amid a backlash over an equal pay lawsuit filed by the U.S. women's team. Here's what happened. The federation's attorneys submitted court filings which stated, and this is a direct quote, that it is undisputed that the job of men's national player requires materially more strength and speed than the job of women's national team player, end quote. Now, it also added that the job of men's players, quote, carries more responsibility than the job of women's players. So many people were shocked and angry about what was written in these official court documents.
Well, as I kept reading, and I'm reading more, I'm getting more disgusted and more agitated and more infuriated.
Retired two-time FIFA Women's World Cup champion and Olympic gold medalist Julie Foudy was disgusted by the document's language. And as you'd expect, soccer superstar and multi-World Cup winner Megan Rapinoe didn't hold back.
I just want to say it's all false. To every girl out there, to every boy out there who watches this team, who wants to be on this team or just wants to live their dream out, you are not lesser just because you are a girl. You are not better just because you're a boy. We are all created equal and should all have an equal opportunity to go out and pursue our dreams.
Kelsey Trainer and Isabel Angel are here to break down what this could mean for the future of U.S. soccer. Kelsey is an attorney and sports writer for Mediaite.com, and Isabel is a senior producer for the podcast Into America from NBC News. She's also a longtime observer and reporter on all things soccer and a former producer here on The Takeaway.
A few years ago, the U.S. women's national soccer team players filed a lawsuit against the U.S. soccer, which is the governing body here in the United States for the sport, saying that they were not getting equal pay for equal work under the law. They alleged that the U.S. soccer pays the men more than the women's team, which they say is unfair and illegal.
So, Kelsey, why did Carlos Cordero resign? Make that link for us.
He resigned because while U.S. soccer, you know, the lawsuit, they filed it last year on International Women's Day, and it's been going on for some time. But what happened was U.S. soccer and the players filed motions for summary judgment. And in those motions, both sides made legal arguments. And one of the legal arguments that U.S. soccer made was essentially that women do not perform equal work on jobs requiring equal effort, responsibility, and skill. They essentially said that things that women are born with are inherently inferior to men, and therefore they should be paid less. So this kind of all came to a head. It's been out there. They've been asking these questions at depositions about, well, you know, wouldn't you lose against a men's team and this and that? And it really came to head in their responses to the motions for summary judgment that came out on March 9th, the day after the She Believes Cup that they played in Harrison, New Jersey. And from that came huge public pressure from sponsors, right? So you had Coke and Deloitte and Volkswagen coming out and saying, this is absolutely disgusting. It's unacceptable and offensive. And so they tried to do some PR spin. They tried to issue an apology right during the She Believes Cup in Houston, and it just did not go well. And so from that, the public pressure, Carlos issued a letter resigning and even said in it, he's like, I did not have the opportunity to even fully review these filings.
So do you think that his resignation could change the women's soccer team's lawsuit in any substantial way?
I do, actually. If you had asked me 2 weeks ago what would happen with this lawsuit, I would have said it's a gray area and there's some legal arguments on both sides. But after these filings, I think that they have totally lost in the court of public opinion. I think the judge in the case has already been on the record calling some of U.S. soccer's arguments absurd, anything having to do with essentially arguing that women are inferior to men inherently. And, you know, you do have a new former player, Cindy Parlow-Cohn, is now the president. She was the former vice president of U.S. soccer. And I do think that the players now have extreme bargaining power in this settlement negotiations.
So, Isabel, I know that you've been to all these games and you've been there with fans cheering equal pay, equal pay, equal pay. Do you think that Cordero's resignation could be a step in the right direction?
I don't know if I would say it'd be a step in the right direction, but I think the players certainly would say this could be a step in the right direction. I think they're pretty quick to say also that, you know, his resignation doesn't erase the hurt and damage that they feel has been done to them. But I think that from what I've seen of fans' reactions and players' reactions, people are saying that this is a positive for them.
U.S. soccer's arguments are still on the record. So on Monday, March 16th, there was reply briefs filed. And, you know, the U.S. soccer did not hit home on any of these arguments. They actually issued a statement saying, you know, we don't believe any of those things. But at the end of the day, they're still on the record. And the players have argued essentially that everything that they were saying in those is proof, literally, of gender discrimination.
Kelsey, Cordero issued another letter before he resigned stating that he offered the team equal pay and they turned it down. Is that true?
So that's what he says. Molly Levinson, the spokesperson for the players, came out and said it's absolutely not true. One, in even releasing that letter, they broke confidentiality issues that had to do with the negotiations going back and forth. And she said that the numbers that they offered us and any offer that they brought to the table was based on the collective bargaining agreement from 2011 for the men. So right now, the men's national team players are in their own collective bargaining process for a new agreement. The players essentially said, okay, you might have offered us equal pay to the men based off of 2011 financials.
So Isabel, if you could take us back for a little bit. Yeah, I know the women's team led a protest during the She Believes Cup. Can you paint that picture for us?
Yeah, so last week before they played their last game of the She Believes Cup, the players came out ready to warm up wearing their warm-up jerseys turned inside out, which basically meant that the crest of U.S. soccer, which is on the front of their jersey, was blank, and you could still make out the four stars that represent each of their World Cup wins. So it was this really powerful statement of saying, you know, they don't feel supported by the federation. They didn't want to represent the federation in that moment, but they were still showing that they're the best national women's team in the world. And they all together, the whole team took a picture before the game, which, you know, is part of the pregame process, but they were all completely unsmiling, just staring at the camera. And I think that really grabbed fans' attention and grabbed attention really all around the country.
So the U.S. Soccer Federation now has a new president who is a woman, Cindy Parlow-Cones. Could this be a new and brighter era for the federation?
I personally think so. I think that, you know, their latest legal filing, like I said, as of Monday night, the 16th, they started their new filing saying that we're deeply supportive of the women's national team on and off the field. They are the best national team in the world. And so their success, I think, is unparalleled by anybody else. And I think there are people, you know, you have incredibly successful women's national teams, former players that are starting to get involved. And I think that those people are going to start joining the ranks of U.S. soccer, and that's what's going to change. Still, overall, you know, Meg Rapinoe also talked about after the She Believes Cup game, she said, listen, we've had these feelings of this discriminatory nature that people thought this way, but to see it written down is just so defeating. And so I think that whether or not they win or lose in court, they've already lost in the court of public opinion, and they've got a lot of making up to do.
Kelsey Traynor is an attorney and sports writer for Mediaite, and Isabel Angel is a senior producer for Into America. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for our show today. You can follow me on Twitter at Duarte Geraldino. And of course, we are keeping an eye on everything COVID-19. We'll be bringing you information and updates each day here on The Takeaway. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Duarte Geraldino. This is The Takeaway. See you again tomorrow. Please stay safe and healthy out there.